Welcome to the Transformational Wealth Podcast with Mark Henn. Mark is devoted to helping you understand how the wealthy invest and explaining how to leverage investment strategies to make the most of your financial situation. In each episode, Mark breaks down key financial strategies and provides direct action steps so you can expand your financial toolkit and change the trajectory of your financial life. He also sits down with individuals who are actively using these wealth-building power plays, giving you real-world insights into how these strategies work in action. Are you ready? Let's jump in and start building your financial future today.
Welcome to the Transformational Wealth Podcast. I'm Mark Henn, CEO of Harvest Financial Advisors. And today, I'm excited to have a longtime friend on here as well, Bruce Mason. He actually is the Director of Research and Trading here at Harvest Financial, Senior VP as well. And so excited to have him here. We're going to talk about paper assets as part of one of the five super asset classes that I reference in my new book, Power Plays of the Wealthy. And so, Bruce, thanks so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you for having me, Mark. It's an honor.
How long have we known each other? I was trying to think about that.
It goes back over two decades. I was thinking about that this morning. Can't put a number on it. It was sometime in the late 90s, probably.
Probably something like that, yeah. And so,
it's certainly been over 25 years around that.
Right. Now, in our office building, we have to call each other on the phone to talk to each other or walk to each other's desks. And when we started out, we would just yell to the next office to each other because
we certainly have come a long way.
Yeah.
from being right next to each other now to being on separate floors in a big building. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So, which is now full. We have to figure out what to do with that as well. So as the growth continues, so we're happy about that. But so I'm going to jump in here. In my book, Power Plays of the Wealthy, we have a section on paper assets. I wanted the book to be something that everybody could take something from. So in the first part of the chapter about paper assets, I talk about what happens, what if we want paper assets to be a job for somebody or be a business for somebody? And there is a way to do that. There are professional traders out there. There are investors that do this full time. And they get a lot of training. They do, use a lot of technical charts and graphs and watch patterns and things like that as well. And that definitely is one path to take that we could talk about. But in the other part of the paper assets chapter, I talk about more let's say somebody is, we might call them an entrepreneur, I've heard, where they don't want to go and start a business. They don't want to do these other things. They like their career. They want to continue just innovating and creating in the job that they're in for the business they're for the company they're working for. But they do want to maximize their savings and their growth on their investments and focus on the paper assets as just an investment piece. And of course, we do a lot of that here for our clients as well in utilizing paper assets as a part of their investment portfolio. And that's the area we're going to talk about today as well, is more on that paper assets investment side, some tips, tricks, pitfalls, great possibilities as well. I love paper assets. I love all the five super asset classes we talk about. I do love paper assets as well for particular reasons. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. And I'm excited to get in this conversation with you as well. So tell us just a little bit about yourself, your history, your background in research, trading on these companies, things like that.
Sure. So let me take you back a little bit. I grew up in the Northeast, outside of New York City, in a small community, mostly a commuter community. Most of the fathers in my town worked in New York City, many of which worked on Wall Street. And that was my initial introduction to Wall Street. It's not that I knew what they did for a living, but I saw the lifestyle they had. I saw how smart these people were. And it was my initial introduction to this is maybe a career path that I'd be interested in.
Right.
I went to college at Michigan State. I gravitated almost immediately to economics.
Right. Big Ten rivals, by the way, right? The Boilermakers, yes. Spartans. Yes. So yeah.
Yeah, we're Big Ten continue. Rivals. So, you know, I immediately found economics resonated with me as a major. You know, why is the world the way it is? Why do companies make the decisions they do? You know, all of these kinds of motivations were fascinating to me. You know, as a 20-year-old, you're being introduced to the bigger picture of the world. After graduating, my first real job out of school was as a mutual fund accountant at Provident Bank, believe it or not. That goes back a ways.
That's right. I do remember that now. Yeah.
I've had an interesting career. Mutual fund accounting was me dipping my toe into the world of finance. And from there, I landed a job with another RIA here in Cincinnati. During which time I progressed from being an operations person to being a financial planner to being a research analyst. During that time, I went back to graduate school and got an MBA from the University of Cincinnati. I worked at that company for probably about 13 years. And that's where I met you, Mark. So it's been a fascinating journey. And of course, the last 17 years here has just been amazing as an opportunity and as an adventure.
So you had that opportunity at the prior firm to be able to kind of transition and grow there from analyst planning and then into the investment research side as well. And of course, that, you know, I saw that the talent that you had as well there. And so I knew I definitely wanted you to be a part of the team when I started Harvest Financial. And so I appreciate you coming on board, and it's been a great run. So far as well. So just going back, what it sounds like is you had kind of this growing up experience. You knew these people were commuting into New York City. They knew a lot. You knew a lot of them worked on Wall Street as well. That was kind of your introduction to the finance world. Like you said, you didn't know maybe what they were doing, but you just had kind of this finance around. You knew they were doing that. Is that what I heard you saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And
I find that interesting because my introduction was a little different, where I wasn't surrounded by that at all. I grew up in the sticks in Southwest Indiana around, you know, my parents were teachers and farmers, but I had a couple of experiences where, you know, I talk about a couple of these in the book, but, you know, as a junior in high school, I had this personal finance class, which I think everybody should have to go through this. It was a phenomenal class. They, you know, taught you how to balance a checkbook and how to buy a car. We actually had to go out and buy a car and go through that process and write a paper on it, how to buy a house, how to invest. They actually would have people come in and talk about fundamental and technical analysis for picking investments as well. Phenomenal class. But we had a chance to buy a stock, the class, and the class chose the stock I wanted to invest into. I remember the name of it as well today, and we held it for 3 months, and the stock was up like 45% in 3 months. It was the best performing stock in the entire stock market. I'd like to say I knew that was going to happen at that time. I had no idea, but that was kind of a hook for me. I was like, this is great. Now, that's not how we invest today, but that was my exposure to this one hit, and I had another hit in college like that. Now, this is exciting. You know, it's something I wanted to be a part of, to help people in that run as well. So I didn't know that. I don't think we've ever talked about that, where you had these fathers commuting or mothers commuting into New York City to work on Wall Street and kind of just having that exposure there as well. So what, let's talk a little bit about, if I'm an investor, a new investor, or maybe I've been around for a while, but I really haven't gotten involved in my investing process. Obviously, we can look to assistance and help. We prefer the fee-only registered investment advisory side of the world, just because of I think it removes those inherent conflicts of interest. But let's walk through that process of some of the things that we look at. Now, I mentioned earlier just a little bit fundamental and technical analysis. Tell us a little bit about each and just kind of what your thoughts are on both of those.
Sure. So, you know, this is a area of research that is a little bit debatable. There are different areas in research, one being fundamental analysis and the other being technical analysis, and they don't often go hand in hand.
Right.
Going back again a little bit, I'll tell you, as a teenager, you may remember back in the days when there were actually newspapers and the internet didn't exist. First thing I would do every morning or afternoon after school would be look for the comic strips. I mean, you know, who didn't want to look at the comic strips?
Sure.
Well, what was just a few pages beyond that? I don't know if you remember. It was the business section of the newspaper.
Oh, sure. All the stocks that were
and
in there
all
as well.
Stock symbols and tickers and stock prices and notations and symbols. It fascinated me. This is as a teenager. Now, again, remember, this was before the internet, so you couldn't easily go online and find the price of a stock going back 10 years.
Right.
So as a teenager, unbeknownst to me, I was deeply into technical analysis. I was creating my own database of stock prices and trying to find patterns. That is essentially what technical analysis is. It's using statistics. It's using probability. Nowadays, it's using computer algorithms and, you know, much more advanced technology than certainly existed in the mid-1980s.
And then those technical analysts, they're looking for patterns, maybe even created as well, right? And
absolutely.
And there might be some fun, catchy names like head and shoulders or reverse head and shoulders, things like that. They're looking for these patterns, right?
Absolutely. So that is the basis of technical analysis. It is trying to look at what's happened and determine what's going to happen in the future based on price movements. It is more of an art than a science.
Yeah.
So that needs to be said. It's very subjective. And while there are certain parameters that are used, every technical analyst does it a little bit differently and making the completely different conclusions looking at the same bunch of data. They all may come to different conclusions. It is a fascinating area, but again, it's an art, not a science.
Right.
On the other hand, fundamental analysis is really what has underpinned research and analysis going back to probably the 1920s, 1930s. Fundamental analysis looks at the actual fundamentals of the companies. So what does their revenue look like? Is their revenue growing? What are their profit margins? What do their earnings look like? Are they expanding their workforce? Are they buying back shares? There are so many different metrics that you can look at a company through. What's their debt on the books? Are they issuing more shares?
Right.
What's the return on investment, ROI, or return on equity? So that is more of a science, and it's certainly been more defined over the last 100 years. It is also more widely accepted as the way you look at stocks and stock performance and how you analyze whether you may want to buy a company or not. Remember, you're not buying a stock, you're buying a company. And that's a very important distinction. For many people who kind of dabble in the market, it's just, hey, this is a hot stock. It's done well. I'm going to buy 10 shares of it. But that's not really investing. Investing is being a shareholder and understanding the company that you're invested in and why you own it, what, in fact, you like about it beyond just, you know, the fact that it's a media darling at the moment or it's a meme stock nowadays.
So I heard once that somebody said technical analysis, they thought it was a bunch of hooey, that it didn't work, but that so many people believed in it, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. So because of that, it works. Because you really don't care what company it is that you're buying or selling under technical analysis in those charts. You just want to see the pattern you're looking for. Whereas what I hear you saying is that on the fundamental analysis side, we are very much, or someone should be very much invested into understanding how that company works, understanding all their fundamental ratios and earnings and things like that to find if it's a good company to invest into long-term. And that takes time. That takes time to research that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I once heard that humans have evolved biologically to find patterns in nature. And I think that's why it's easy for a layperson to look at a chart and try and find patterns. It's a biological motivation. But as far as investing goes, it sometimes isn't the best method to determine whether or not a company is a good long-term investment. As you said, you know, you don't need to pick a company. You can just look for patterns and volatility in any stock and try and figure out when the best opportunity to get in and get out. That's really hard, and it's very subjective, and oftentimes is fraught with problems. It often doesn't work the way you anticipate.
So when you're looking for those, we're looking for individual companies, I'll say something like that. What are some positive things, or what are some negative things that you might see that might attract you towards a company, or may make you want to keep away from a company? Sure. I always joke, the one that I always hear, if I ever heard on the TV something about this company's being investigated for accounting irregularities, I'm like, you know, that just screams, get away from me right now.
Well, so first and foremost, you want a company that has a product that people want to buy. Plain and simple. Mm-hmm. It's got to be a company that's selling something that is either necessary or that people just really desire. For example, the iPhone. You know, do people need it? No, but it's a very desirable product. So look for companies that sell things that are popular or necessary. But more importantly, you want companies that are growing. It's so easy for a company to rest on its laurels and stop innovating. I look at IBM, you know, or Eastman Kodak, or some of these companies from, you know, decades past that are just a shadow of what they used to be. Mm-hmm. Those are companies that didn't innovate. They didn't keep up with the times. So you want a company that's innovating. And the way you'll know that is that their revenues are growing. They're not stagnant, and they're not declining. Beyond that, you know, how a company is run is very important.
So first of all, before you get into that, just to go back and just kind of summarize. So one, without naming any particular companies or anything, you know, what I hear you saying is that look for those products that are innovative, that actually people now have incorporated into their lives, like smartphones, things like that, and look for companies that continue to innovate, because there are some that may have been around for a long time that stop innovating and we don't see them anymore. Is that kind of what you're saying, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Yeah, please continue. Yeah.
So, you know, beyond revenue, you're also looking for companies that have a wide moat. And by that, I mean companies that make something that isn't easy to replicate. So, you know, if you have the technology or the resources that other companies don't have, that gives you a real competitive advantage as a company. You don't want to be making something that a competitor can easily copy or come in and undermine you with lower prices. That is a very difficult environment to operate in. So you want companies that have a wide moat. Not easily replicable, and something that you have a competitive advantage in. That would be the next thing I'd look at. But beyond that, you know, there are all of the fundamental details, and there are too many to mention here. But earnings, obviously, is the biggest one. Beyond revenue growth, you want to see earnings grow as well. Now, that's not always going to be the case, particularly with a younger company or startup. A lot of the free cash flow may go into building out manufacturing or increasing capacity, R&D, hiring more employees. So your earnings may not be growing very quickly. And, you know, I know you remember this, Mark. Back in the early days of Apple, you know, we looked at Apple. Oh, I take that back. It wasn't Apple. It was Amazon. You'll remember this. And it was taking off. The revenue was growing astronomically, but the earnings were actually negative quarter over quarter, year over year. And that went on for years. And it was because it was during the time that Amazon was building out its infrastructure, its distribution centers, its warehouses, its all of the infrastructure. And it was costing a lot of money. It happened early on with Tesla, too. Not that we own Tesla, but, you know, Elon Musk spent a fortune building out the manufacturing capacity for Tesla, and that created negative earnings for years. He was spending more than the company was earning.
Right.
And so earnings is important.
And I'll throw this in there, you know, just not that we're recommending or not recommending any of the individual stocks that maybe are mentioned here as well, but just a reference from a historical standpoint, to your point, these companies would innovate and they needed cash to innovate, right? They had to continue to spend and spend. So what I hear you saying is that you may see that at the beginning of a company as it is maturing, it may spend a lot of cash at the beginning and then continue to move forward with at some point, maybe even starting to return some of that back to the shareholders through dividends or things like that, or become more mature, have more cash flow to address other issues, getting outside of that growing phase as well. So as we look at those fundamental factors that, you know, earnings and things like that, and that just takes time and understanding to look at that as well. We then have to deal with that, or a lot of people have to deal with that stock market overlay. Sometimes I'll mention, you know, if I had an opportunity to buy these companies, when you look at a company, you should be looking at a company, I want to buy these because of what the company does and how they're progressing and how they're growing. I think that's a great investment. But then we have the stock market overlay as well. And that's where those emotions of fear and greed sometimes are brought in, well, a lot of times brought in, the market itself, individual investors as well. You know, just speak a little bit on this kind of that market overlay and how that emotion, you know, almost, you almost have to like discount it to a certain extent.
Yeah. As investors, it is very easy to get caught up in your emotions. As a professional investor, investing other people's money, you know, I'm able to remove a lot of that emotion from the decision-making process. But when you're making decisions for yourself, it's your nest egg, it's your retirement savings, you're seeing the market go down, it's very easy to get caught up in the fear. And certainly the media helps facilitate the growth of that fear. It's very easy to get caught up in that. On the flip side, when the market's going up, like it has the last couple of years, it's very easy to get caught up in the greed side of it. You know,
right.
The market's up 20% and you are only up 16 or 17% and you're upset that, you know, I should have gotten at least 20, maybe 22 or 25
right.
without recognizing that a 17% return is amazing. Historically and on average, you beat the returns significantly. Now, it does create a lot of emotional decision making for people. You got to remember, investing is a long term project, so to speak.
Yeah.
It's not about trying to time the market. It's not about getting in and out quickly. It's not about, day trading. That is not investing. That's speculating.
Yeah.
That's,
and one thing,
a long time horizon.
I think having that long-term time horizon is very important. One of the things, though, and I remember I wrote an article about this many years ago, because I think financial advisors are really great at telling their clients, think about the long term, think about the long term, things like that. However, it's the short term that generate the emotions and dictate some clients' movements in there as well. So when I say think about the short term as well, We want to make sure that we reference the fact that the short-term emotions can move people to do actions that aren't beneficial to their portfolio or their investments. And as they're thinking about designing their portfolio or investing at the beginning, really focus on the risk side of it as well. How much risk am I willing to take and to design the portfolio to handle that much risk so you can sleep at night? So when you go through down periods, you know, when things go on sale, you can actually be excited about maybe going and buying something on sale like you would at a department store or a grocery store or something like that, buy a new shirt, whatever. But not have it be so volatile and so far down that you just sell everything and step aside, which we've seen people do as well. So that that risk aspect. And that's where that market overlay comes in, where you almost have to kind of even let yourself know there's going to be this volatility. There's going to be these emotions that rear up in me when I see this going on. Have a consistent process and a path to follow for that long term project of my investment portfolio, whatever. And that's absolutely, I think that's really important. So before we go on, I'm just shout out to our sponsor, which happens to be you've already heard this name. This episode of Power Plays of the Wealthy and the Transformational Wealth Podcast is sponsored by Harvest Financial Advisors, a team of seasoned professionals committed to helping clients grow, protect, and enjoy their wealth. Whether you're building wealth, planning for retirement, or looking for smart investment strategies, our team is here to guide you every step of the way. Visit harvestadvisors.com to learn more. Now let's get back to our conversation here. You know, let's talk about that power of starting saving and investing today, maybe for the future for anyone. How, you know, the compounding over time and building wealth for the future. You know, what have just kind of been your some observations, things that you've seen in that realm of people just in that process?
Sure. So, I mean, if I'm being honest, my biggest regret is that I didn't start saving sooner. I think a lot of
people, yourself,
myself,
yourself.
Yes,
okay,
myself.
Great.
Now, there are always reasons why we couldn't save. We were having a family, we were buying a house, there were unexpected expenses and emergencies. That's understandable. But I think for a lot of people, we underestimate the power of compounding returns. Mm-hmm. There are studies, and it can be mathematically shown, I'm sure you've seen this, where you compare two individuals, somebody in their 20s, you know, contributing a few hundred dollars a month or a couple hundred dollars a month for their entire life up until retirement, versus somebody who starts saving even just 10 years later at the age of 30. And what those studies indicate, and it's pretty black and white, it's pretty factual, is that the person starting at the age of 30 has to save substantially more money every month to catch up to the person who started at the age of 20. It's pretty mind-boggling. In some cases, it's two or three times as much. And in some cases, they never catch up by the time they hit retirement. So the earlier you can start saving, the better. Now, that's not always easy, particularly when you're young. And in this environment, in this economy, that certainly is a challenge.
Right.
But, you know, as a parent, if you can help contribute maybe to your kids' IRAs, assuming they've got earned income, you know, giving them that leg up early means a world of difference 30 years down the line. You know,
moms and dads of the world, do you hear this out there? That
I mean,
your children want you to contribute to their savings.
Well, you know, I, obviously that's not possible for everybody,
but
if it is possible, it's something you should consider, because giving them that leg up early on makes a huge difference on the back end 30 years down the road.
I heard once, you know, just the power of just saving. And in fact, at the beginning, it's not even so much the rate of return that you get. You know, if I save $1,000 and got a 50% rate of return, I have $1,500. Well, what's that extra I could tout that I made a 50% rate of return, but what's that extra $500 really going to do for me? So the real main focus, especially at the beginning, is just have a plan, have a structure in place, save that you and then start that long-term growth, because we all know that compounding at the end of that period of time really starts to grow. So for instance, if I look at one doubling period, if I have $50,000 in my retirement plan and it doubles, it's going to go to $100,000. Well, if I had $1 million in my retirement plan through that same doubling period, the same amount of time, now I have $2 million. That's a huge difference from a number standpoint. And so it's the fact of starting early and saving. And in fact, in the book, we talk a little bit about comparing a couple of things. One, somebody starting today and getting about 10% of savings into their retirement plan. And then what if they actually doubled that savings? That may be difficult to do. What does that impact look like over the long term? And what we show is that, you know, if you're able to save 20% with all the other same assumptions, you could actually retire with the same amount of money probably about 7 years earlier than if you just save 10%. Now, that doesn't sound like a whole lot, but, you know, if what could you do with that additional 7 years of life if you said, I'm done now at 58 versus 65, something like that? And in addition to that, to embolden those that maybe didn't start soon, we even have a in the book, we even show an example of somebody that started saving at 40, what they actually could do over time as well. So it's never too late is one thing, but second, earlier than later is always better as well when it comes to the to those savings also. What have you seen as some of the biggest mistakes maybe that individual investors make? And I, as a side note, I want to say this. We typically use individual securities when we are investing portfolios, but a lot of clients don't have the time, as my hearing piece falls out. A lot of people don't have the time or the resources to do that as well. So then they need to look at something like a mutual fund or exchange traded fund, something like that as well. And if you don't have the time to research individual securities, you know, I would look towards those other options because you want to have some diversification. But there's some research that goes into that as well. We'll talk about in a minute. But heading back to, you know, some of the biggest mistakes you might have seen, what are some of those that you've seen investors make that Sure. you would encourage the listeners to try to avoid?
Well, the biggest mistake is to see investing as more of a speculative endeavor akin to gambling. And right. nobody wants to say they're a gambler, but a lot of quote unquote investors really are just gambling. Investing has to do with a long time horizon through multiple business cycles over decades. Right. That's investing. The biggest mistake is buying the hot stock because you think, you know, you heard something, a friend told you something. You saw something on TV or in a business publication that said this is the next big thing without actually doing the research to figure out, you know, again, getting back to the fundamentals, whether this is actually a good company or not. So buying the hot stock frequently isn't a great plan. Right. The other mistake people make is that they look at past returns and they just assume that future returns will be similar. So if a stock has had a meteoric rise, they assume that it'll just continue on this meteoric path. That often isn't the case. You know, you do see right. that sometimes with these meme stocks where, again, I would avoid them, certainly, but people get hooked on this idea that, you know, because of the volatility, their wild swings, they can make a buck doing it. Mm. That's not investing. That's gambling. Lastly, I would say that one of the biggest mistakes many, many investors make is a lack of diversification. We've seen that over the last couple of years where, you know, this group of seven stocks, they call them the Magnificent Seven, mostly tech companies, made up an astounding portion of the returns of the indices these last couple of years. We've seen in the NASDAQ in particular, you know, a tremendous return. And so people get caught up in buying a handful of names that are all in the same sector or all in the same industry even. Right. And that presents a lot of risk. So diversification is an area that a lot of people don't take seriously enough.
So the idea that, you know, you said a couple of things too, that diversification, you know, making sure that, you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier too, stick with a plan. I see a lot of emotions dictating investment decisions that can be a huge mistake as well. You know, don't ignore those indications of the emotions, but recognize what they are. Is this just short-term volatility? Is this something that we need to address more seriously as well? And then you mentioned, you know, the idea that, well, go back to the diversification aspect. We kind of joke that sometimes you can have too many securities as well, and we call that diversification. Okay. Yes. And so it's something where then you get the best companies, but you also get the mediocre and worst companies as well if it's over diversified as well. But to your point, that diversification is very important. to have that in the portfolio and not to focus on the hot trends.
There's one other thing I forgot to mention.
Oh,
and
please.
It's equally important, if not more important than everything I've just said. That is, as you pointed out, emotions often get the better of us.
When right.
the market's not doing well, there's an inclination to want to sell all, go to cash, and just wait. And, you know, logically, that seems like that's a good decision, right? You're protecting your assets. The problem with that is that you never know when to get back in.
Right.
And so what ends up happening is you sell, maybe the market even goes further down, and so you feel vindicated. You made a great decision. See, you are smart. You protected your nest egg. Then in the months that follow, the market goes up and up. And then one day suddenly it spikes and it's up 10%, you know,
right.
5%. And now suddenly the market's a lot higher than where you sold and you're still sitting in cash. And now you
right.
feel like maybe you've missed out. If you just can wait a little bit, it'll fall again and then you can buy it back at a better price.
Right.
And this cycle of waiting deteriorates your returns and your plans with regards to
yeah.
when you could retire in many cases because you've sat on cash for far too long. You know, they say, and I know it sounds trite, but time in the market is more important than trying to time the market. And
right.
it really is something to live by. During those
yeah.
emotional periods where you're fearful, do not give into the inclination to sell and go to cash because inevitably you will miss the return and be in a worse position than had you just held on and not given into those emotions.
And I think that's a great point. I multiple, you know, it's interesting. This has happened multiple times over my career where someone will walk in a new client and say, here's my portfolio. It's sitting, you know, it's 2016 and it's sitting all in cash. And they went to cash at the end of 2008 and just never got back in. And they want to, you know, they're wondering when they should get back in and they've missed this big run from that bottom in the portfolio. And so I wonder if that leads to maybe more of a focus on if you're continuing to invest and save that dollar cost averaging focus. So as opposed to trying to time the market, you know, which I don't think works. I know you don't think it works either. Just the idea of dollar cost averaging into the market over time and more focusing on that and let, you know, the idea that if the market's down, great, I'm still investing. That means I'm buying some things at cheaper prices as well, even when things go down. You know, I wonder if that, if we more focus on that longer term, at least historically, that seems to have been a better path to take. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Again, trying to time the market is, it's impossible, if I'm being honest. And,
yeah.
and for those who think that, you know, they can do it consistently over a period of 40 years or 35 years, it's an impossibility. I mean, I'm here to tell you that.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I, as a side note, you know, in the chapter on paper assets in Power Plays of the Wealthy, I do address private equity as well. That's also a paper asset. I just want to reference something here is that when we, if you evaluate private equity, it's actually a completely different, not completely different, but there's other different metrics you're looking for when you evaluate private equity versus like a publicly traded company. And the main thing is that as you're looking at fundamentals, private equity typically are forecasts of what they think is going to happen, where while a publicly traded entity has forecasts of things they think are going to happen, you actually have actual real track records, a track record of past historical numbers, fundamentals that you can look at. So just as a comment, if you're looking at private equity, there's a different path to follow. We're not going to get into that today, but there's other things you need to look at, especially like their marketing teams and things like that. So I just want to throw that out there that it is a different process as well. It sounds like we have a parade going by outside as well.
We do, unfortunately. I apologize.
So what are some of the, as we think about those individuals then that we've got them saving, they're putting their money in. We've convinced them that this is a long-term path and they're moving forward, but it's an individual investor. They haven't hired anybody to help them. They don't have time to study individual securities as well. It seems like a logical path might be using exchange traded funds or ETFs or yes. mutual funds as well. Are there any things an individual investor should look for when they're looking at some of these other diversified positions already?
So
that are out there?
Yeah. So, you know, going back a few decades, mutual funds were the entry into investing. It was because there were no commissions. There was no trading costs on those investments, as opposed to stocks, which, you know, weren't as diversified, and you were going to pay a commission on placing the trade and selling position.
Right.
What came out in the last, you know, 10, 15 years are ETFs or exchange traded funds. During that period, many of the largest custodians and investment companies did away with trading commissions. You know, originally they went down to like $9.99 a trade, and then it went to zero. And so it allowed right. for this entire new industry of ETFs to emerge. Now, the beauty of ETFs is that they're very inexpensive in terms of the management. Most of them are passive, which means they try and mimic an index.
Okay.
So you can buy an S&P 500 ETF or a Russell 2000 ETF. There are a few things. They're diversified, which is what you want. They're low cost, meaning, you know, you're not going to pay 1% of the asset or of the return each year to a manager, you know, managing the mutual fund. ETFs typically have anywhere from, you know, 2 to 10 basis points in cost, which is extremely low. And lastly, there are tax benefits in the sense that ETFs don't have to pay out distributions each year that, you know, if it was in a brokerage account, you'd end up having to pay taxes on.
So mutual funds have to do that, correct? They have to pay out most of their earnings.
Okay, absolutely. All right. They have to pay out the income out of the fund each year. And in some years it's small, but in other years it could be really large. And in the last 2 years, we've seen very large distributions. Again, it causes some taxable consequences. ETFs are probably the better bet now since you don't have to pay any trading costs for them, and they're well diversified and they're passive. Right. For somebody just starting out, that's probably the best approach. You can buy one, you know, broad-based ETF, or you can buy several ETFs to diversify further with, you know, large cap, mid cap, small cap, or growth versus blend versus value. There's right. so many ways to slice and dice it nowadays that didn't exist even 20 years ago.
Now, and a little different. Oh, go ahead.
If you're a larger investor, and let's say, you know, you have somewhat of a nest egg built and you're uncomfortable managing it yourself, you don't quite know what's the best way to diversify. Or in that case, I'd highly encourage you to find a financial professional, particularly a fee-only professional, who yes. can help walk you through retirement projections and some financial planning, but who can also help you on the investment side, help you with the diversification to make sure you're not taking more risk than you need to. That's all really important.
Right.
So from young investors to, you know, middle age and older investors, there's a wide range of opportunities to be found.
And I think there's a lot to be said. I appreciate bringing up a lot to be said for, you know, looking at different tax environments as well. We're not going to get into that today, but I talk a little bit more about it in the book as well. But the different tax environments you can invest into, there's tax-free, income tax-free, like Roth IRAs. There's income tax deferred, like traditional IRAs or traditional 401ks. Of course, there are Roth 401ks as well. Some companies will have that. You have to look at those. There's even something called the super mega Roth. There's a chart in there of some phenomenal things you can do with Roth dollars as well, or after tax dollars in those plans. And of course, there's the brokerage world. Each one of those has a different tax environment, and structuring those different tax environments together is just as much of a process for planning and investing as doing the investments as well. So there's a whole world of things that an advisor is trying to do. When you look for an advisor, I highly encourage you to look for one that is a fiduciary in everything that they do. And that's typically in the registered investment advisory world, fee-only firms that are out there to find that help. That's where we typically would want you to look for that assistance as well. So what I heard you saying, going back to those exchange-traded funds and mutual funds, you mentioned 2 to 10 basis points on the fees in an exchange-traded fund. Just for the listeners that aren't familiar with that, so that's about 0.02 to 0.1%. In management fees. Now, mutual funds typically have a higher expense ratio of could be 0.7, 0.8, 1.2%. So they're typically higher in expenses if they're actively managed, a little bit lower if they're passively managed, where they're not trading in it. But exchange traded funds, what I hear you saying, typically have lower fees. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you want to make sure they are diversified. But, you know, crack open the inside of that exchange traded fund. Make sure you know what's in there. Do they own 200 companies? I've seen ETFs that own 20 companies. You want to make sure you know what you're getting when you're doing that investing, buying that ETF as well. So what I hear you saying, some of the best ways, you know, for new investors to begin saving and investing and into the paper assets world is utilize those environments, maybe Roth IRAs, traditional IRAs, your retirement plans at your work as well. Start saving, especially if there's like a company match. That's some of the best ways for somebody to get started, correct?
I'm glad you mentioned the 401k. I forgot about that. If your company offers a match, that's free money. Take advantage of it. That's an instant return on your savings. So absolutely, if you have a 401k available to you, start saving in that, particularly if you have a match.
Yeah. So you know, what we want people to take away from this is, you know, if you're going to do in paper assets, on the investment piece, on the investment vehicle side of things, if you're going to do the work yourself, be prepared to put the time and work into it. Don't think that you can just do the individual stocks on a consistent basis without putting the work and time into it, because it does take time. And there are things you have to look at and research to form your pattern, your path you're going to follow as well. And then on the actual starting the investment piece, just start to save. Use those investment vehicles that give you the better tax treatment in the future, either tax deferred now, and you can grow those dollars tax-free, like in a Roth IRA, where those right now, you know, when those assets grow in the future, you can pull those out income tax free. Just do, you know, understand those different tax environments and how you can use those to your advantage as you move forward. And you'll have a great investment strategy laid out, and just make sure to be prepared to help control your risk. See the market drops and, you know, as an opportunity, as you dollar cost average or saving, see those as opportunities to buy things at cheaper prices. And that's going to be an advantage for you down the road, not to let that emotion of fear step in, or the emotion of greed, to really kind of dictate what you're looking at there as well. And so as we wrap up here, I ask this question of everybody. You know, the name of the podcast is Transformational Wealth. So what does the term transformational wealth mean to you?
That's a good question, because I'm sure you're going to get a different answer from everybody that you ask that question.
Right.
For me, transformational wealth means security. It means being able to choose to do the things you want to do without having to worry about how the bills are going to get paid, or that the bills can get paid even. You know, having that security really is transformational. It's just allows you to live the life that you want to live, rather than being a slave to a job that maybe you don't like. Maybe that is wearing you out. It's maybe a physical job. You know, you can't do it forever. Having the discipline to save and create that wealth can be very transformational in that regard. Just that the security of having a future and knowing that you're going to be okay.
So by someone starting that plan, starting that process of saving, investing, growing, being purposeful in that, at some point their wealth kind of transforms into a bucket, a nest egg, whatever term we want to use, mm-hmm. that transforms their, even maybe their lifestyle from not necessarily I can spend more, but even just in the fact that you can get security from this. Now I'm at a point where my wealth now has transformed to a place where I have the security, where I can step out, walk out, live my life, maybe have some freedoms, mm-hmm. Different freedoms, things like that. That's what's kind of transforming for you as you
Absolutely.
See it.
Absolutely. I think you okay. couldn't have put it better. It gives you a freedom.
Great. Great. Well, hey, I appreciate you joining us so much, my friend. Again, thanks to Bruce Thank Mason, you, Director of Research and Trading here at Harvest Financial Advisors. Again, you can visit harvestadvisors.com, our sponsor, for to get more information about them. Check out my website, markhen.com. There's also powerplaysofthewealthy.com. You'll find additional resources and things to look at as well, some charts, graphs, things that you can look at as well in more detail. Again, thank you so much, and blessings to you all.
Thank you for listening to the Transformational Wealth Podcast with Mark Henn. Mark is devoted to helping you understand how the wealthy invest and explaining how to leverage investment strategies to make the most of your financial situation. Are you ready to leverage the power plays and attain financial freedom? Visit markhenn.com to tap into the power plays of the wealthy to start building your financial future today.